So as I began working on this morning's sermon, I could not help but think how cool it is to be considering the history of women's suffrage, particularly the journey of Black women and their steadfast and hard-won fight and right to vote. While we here at ERIF are hosting early voting for all the people of Durham, North Carolina. Here on this campus, and for such an important election. It is also gratifying to know that there are people here in this congregation who are deeply engaged in the effort to get out the vote, making certain that people are registered and know when, where, and how to vote. While voting still remains difficult for far too many of the citizens of our state and our country, this morning we can acknowledge we've traveled a distance from where we all once were. And so it is with this in mind that I wonder if you all of you, would humor me with a little exercise. Are you willing? All right. So if you or members of your family would have identified as Black or African American, Native American, Latinx, or of Asian heritage prior to 1965, please raise your hand. If you would have identified as female, keep your hands up, please keep your hands up, don't put them down. If you would have identified as female in 1920, please raise your hand, and I know that some of you already have your hands raised. So if you would have identified as female in 1920, please raise your hand. Come on, ladies, raise your hands. I know you're out there. I see you. I'm looking at you. So let's take a look around the room. Let's all take a look around the room. And simply notice the hands that are raised. And so keep your hands up. And I have one last request, and this might be a little challenging for some, but it's simply for the purpose of our observation. If your hand is not up, would you please rise in body as you are able? If your hand is not up. Yes. Everyone else, you can put your hands down. And so let us simply notice again. These are the people in the room who, as citizens of the United States, would have been free to vote with little or no question prior to the passage of the 15th Amendment in 1870, which gave Black men the right to vote, or passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, which gave women the right to vote, and certainly prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. You may be seated, gentlemen. And so thank you all for indulging me. I wanted to do this little exercise not to embarrass anyone, but because sometimes having a physical and very visible example of an issue such as this allows us to have an opportunity to appreciate what was at stake, what continues to be at stake when it comes to issues of voting, and how important all those previous fights for suffrage, the right to vote, have been, even though some of them have been quite ugly and messy fights. And also how, through almost unnoticeable and intentionally vague language in our Constitution, the right to vote is actually not a universal right in our Constitution. The 15th and 19th Amendments are simply non-discrimination clauses that history has demonstrated have been easily sidestepped even to the present day. The right to vote remains tenuous for so many people in our country, including some of us who are here in this room at this very moment. And thus, it requires our ongoing vigilance, resilience, and resolve. Earlier, we lifted up the words of Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, who is not only one of our celebrated Unitarian African-American ancestors, but she also is an example to us of what most American women of the 19th and early 20th centuries were concerned with and up against, most particularly the black women of her time. Frances Ellen was born a free black woman in 1925 in Baltimore, Maryland. After her mother died, she was raised from the age of three by her maternal uncle, William Watkins, an outspoken abolitionist and educator known for his racial pride, radical anti-slavery speeches, and incendiary essays. A political figure in Baltimore during the early 19th century, Watkins even influenced the thinking of Unitarian newspaper publisher William Lloyd Garrison, whose anti-slavery newspaper, The Liberator, was so popular and radical in its stance to abolish slavery that slaveholders considered Garrison to be the most feared abolitionist of the time. As her guardian uncle, William Watkins became Frances Ellen's father, teacher, and political mentor. She moved to Philadelphia in 1853, where she became involved with the anti-slavery office and the Underground Railroad. And in 1854, on her 29th birthday, she gave her first anti-slavery lecture and began traveling and lecturing throughout the northern states and into Canada. At this time in our history, the women's rights movement in the United States was closely allied with the anti-slavery movement. Before the Civil War, black and white abolitionists and suffragists worked together. A small cohort of formerly enslaved and free black women worked in collaboration with white abolitionists and women's rights activists, with prominent free black women such as Frances Harper assuming leadership positions at women's rights gatherings throughout the 1850s and 1860s. Unfortunately, though mainstream women's rights activists such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony worked to help eradicate the institution of slavery, they were not interested in seeing that former slaves would have citizenship or voting rights. Their focus was on suffrage for middle and upper class white women who sought the same power as their husbands. And so high-profile leaders in the mainstream suffrage movement did not support the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which granted formerly enslaved people citizenship rights. And when the proposal for the 15th Amendment, which would give black men the vote, when that came before Congress, Stanton, Anthony, and others vehemently denounced black male suffrage, not on the grounds that universal suffrage was needed for all people, but simply on the grounds that black men should not receive the vote before white women. Professor Lisa Trautalt of Carnegie Mellon University and author of the award-winning book, The Myth of Seneca Falls, Memory and the Women's Suffrage Movement, writes that Stanton railed against ignorant black manhood voting before educated white womanhood, and she hurled racial epithets. Not only would, to her mind, unfit freedmen be allowed to vote, she warned, but immigrant men too, increasing the ranks of ignorant, incompetent voters to epidemic proportions. Susan B. Anthony backed up Stanton, arguing, if the vote was to be given piece by piece, then give it first to women, to the most intelligent and capable of the women at least. Clearly, points out Professor Trautalt, meeting native-born white women and displaying her own deeply held sense of racial hierarchy. The remarks of mainstream suffragists about black men evoked intense anger on the part of black suffragists, such as Frances Harper, and also Frederick Douglass, who knew Cady and Stanton personally, and who himself had been a supporter of the women's rights movement. Black suffragists publicly denounced these women's views and supported the 15th Amendment, believing that ongoing vigilante violence across the South gave black men the greater priority. Black women saw black male suffrage as important, as an important part of their own suffrage goals. But the damage had been done. And a very explicit division in the women's movement erupted, with former multiracial alliances steadily deteriorating. Santon and Anthony formed a new organization, the National Woman Suffrage Association, to oppose the 15th Amendment and to pursue their own vision of an amendment granting women suffrage. But after the 15th Amendment was ratified in 1870, the NWSA then resorted to increasingly discriminatory practices and even condoned white supremacist ideologies well into the early 20th century in order to gain Southern support for white women's voting rights. They believed that racial exclusion was the only way to get Southern states to ratify the 19th Amendment. The fallout of all of this was that African American women and men became increasingly marginalized and discriminated against at women's suffrage meetings, campaigns, and marches, as well as at the polls. By 1913, many states, not just in the South, had placed significant restrictions upon voting, selectively targeting men of color, Latino, Black, and immigrant, through poll taxes, literacy tests, and more. The precise language of these new laws did not mention race, which is what the 15th Amendment was all about, that you could not discriminate against someone's voting rights because of race. So these laws did not mention them race, and so it made them legal under the 15th Amendment. By the first decades of the 20th century, most men of color had been thrown off the voter rolls, especially in the South, until their numbers had dwindled to almost none. Black women, meanwhile, continued their efforts in other ways. They organized their own club movement in the late 19th century with an eye toward organizing not simply for the right to vote, but for human rights in general, the rights of both men and women, and including poor white women. Their motto was "Lifting as We Climb." And from their unique vantage point, they viewed women's rights as being in the service of human rights. Women like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper understood that she lived within a system of complex, multifaceted oppression that was violently enforced. It existed at the intersection of racism, sexism, and classism that was unique to Black women and other women of color. And it was because of this very position that Black women tended to focus on human rights and universal suffrage rather than suffrage solely for African Americans or solely for women. Frances Harper's biographer says her vision evolved from her relentless intellectual and political involvement with the Black American dilemma and progressive human rights. The rights of women and men alike. The politics of suffrage for Black women was not simply about an individual right to vote, but was holistic and interconnected with broader concerns about anti-lynching, temperance, Jim Crow laws, education, prison reform, sexual violence, access to housing, and the rights of working people. After the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which supposedly gave all women the right to vote, Black women continued to find themselves disenfranchised. Millions of them protested after 1920 and sought the support of women from the mainstream suffrage movement, but they were ignored. Undeterred, they continued to organize their communities locally, regionally, and nationally. For Black women, the movement for suffrage was to extend for another 45 years and was met by tremendous obstacles, including life-threatening violence and, some cases, death, until the establishment of the Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so as we consider today the various forms that voter suppression takes now, or perhaps even other aspects of justice which might concern us, there are several insights I believe we might gain from this messy and, to my mind, very disappointing story of the women's suffrage movement and the interaction of its various players. I have a few things that come to my mind, and perhaps some others might come to yours as well. So the first is this, that our efforts and our issues need to move beyond a collective I to a collective we. How much broader and more inclusive can we make the issues that we're concerned with? We can usually find out by looking around and seeing who is not in the room or at the table as we make our plans or engage in our discussions and decisions. Are we only speaking to ourselves? If our hearts and minds are truly open to what it is we don't know, the people who are most marginalized, most oppressed, can point us true north in a way that expands our thinking, letting us know what we haven't yet thought about, or perhaps even begun to consider. Second, we must listen when these people speak. It's easy to invite people in and then ignore or dismiss what their issues are, because it feels too complex or not relevant to a set of assumptions or agenda we've started out with. But it just might be possible that we've got a whole lot more to learn and that our agenda needs to expand and become in service to more than the issue we might have begun with. We've got to be ready for a long game, accepting that we might not be around to see the change we're fighting for. But this doesn't mean that we give up, give in, or fight any less valiantly. Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and many others in the suffrage movements were not alive by the time the 19th Amendment passed. And thousands upon thousands of others were not alive by the time of the Federal Voting Rights Act in 1965. Next, and this is really important, so listen carefully. Deal with your crap. Deal with your ugliness. Sometimes on the journey toward justice, we discover something that's not too pleasant about ourselves. And if we're really engaging in our work, that is bound to happen for all of us. We discover there's some aspect of who we are or some beliefs we're holding that needs some serious reappraisal and cleaning up. And our ego gets in our way. While even black women suffragists were not happy that black men got the vote before they did, they set their egos aside on behalf of the greater need. But Stanton and Cady became stuck on the issue and engaged in terrible rhetoric and actions that have actually impacted relationships between white and black women's movements to this very day. And finally, as Angela Davis says, let us embrace the principle of lifting as we climb. No action is ever about us alone. Someone somewhere is impacted always by what we do. And we can get so much more done if we are thinking about who we're bringing along with us in our work. Indeed, Frances Harper told members of the American Equal Rights Association that they were all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And she offered a human rights vision at the core of black women's suffrage, thinking about suffrage. And so it's with this in mind that I leave you with these words of Mary Church Terrell, a charter founder of the NAACP and the first president of the National Association of Colored Women. She wrote, "And so lifting as we climb, onward and upward we go, struggling and striving and hoping that the buds and blossoms of our desires will burst into glorious fruition ere long. With courage born of success achieved in the past, with a keen sense of the responsibility which we shall continue to assume, we look forward to a future large with promise and large with hope. May it be so." Jay.